the cheapest kind. It didn't make sense to Virgil. The brand she picked was 3 times bigger than other ice cream. It came in a big plastic tub, but it didn't taste very good. It seemed like more ice cream would cost more money, but apparently that's not how the world of ice cream worked. Virgil would rather have less if it tasted better. Lola kept her eyes on the peas.
"Strawberry," she said.
Virgil would have preferred French vanilla, but he didn't want to press his luck. He was scanning the ice cream, looking for the perfect kind, one with chunks of real, actual strawberries, when another familiar face appeared, reflected in the glass. Chet Bullens. The Bull. Pug-faced boy, as Lola would say, even though she'd never seen him with her own eyes, was right behind him, talking to his father. It was as if there was a Boyd Middle School reunion at the Super Saver. The two people who ruled most of his thoughts were under this one industrial roof, right alongside 2-for-1 soda and bargain mangoes. The Bull hadn't seen him. Not yet. Virgil immediately opened the freezer. The door fogged quickly, obscuring Bull Jr. and Bull Sr., but more importantly, obscuring him. He stood there until goosebumps erupted on his arms, until his teeth rattled, until he was sure the Bullens boys were gone, and Lola called from the end of the aisle, "Hurry up, Anak!" He grabbed the container closest to him, without even looking.
Chapter 9. Valencia. My name could lead people into battle. Valencia! 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 Whether you think it or write it on paper, it's a good, strong name. The name of someone who enters a room and says, "Here I am," instead of, "Where are you?" Valencia Somerset. Yes, it's a good name. Mom says they were going to name me Amy, but she took one look at me and saw Valencia. My name is one of the only things that my mother and I agree on, even right now. We're in the freezer aisle at the grocery store, and she's reaching for the steak fries instead of the curly fries, and seriously, who thinks steak fries are better? I tap her on the shoulder so she's facing me and say, "Can't we get the curly kind?" The buzz of the freezers hums in my hearing aids and drowns out most of her words, but I don't need to hear her clearly to know that she's saying no and talking about how I can buy whatever kind of fries I want when I'm older and have my own money for groceries, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. I didn't even want to come to the grocery store because it's boring, and she never lets me get anything I want, but she said I had to come because my dad wasn't home from work yet, and she needed help loading and unloading the groceries. There's no arguing with her, anyway. You never win. Never. So now I'm here against my will, and I'm already grouchy because I had the nightmare again last night. I woke up with my heart pounding so hard I thought it would burst right out of my chest. I couldn't go back to sleep after that. So I've been awake since before dawn. The only good thing about waking up before dawn is you get to see the sunrise. It happens slow and fast all at once, which is my favorite thing about it. You have to catch it at just the right time. If you do, you can watch the sky shift from gray to auburn, and next thing you know, it's morning. No more darkness. So I survived one nightmare, and now I'm stuck in another. The Super Saver with Mom. "Go get me 3 avocados, she says, like I'm her personal servant. Then she gestures toward the produce section, which is like 500 aisles away. Great. Now I have to find the avocados, and I don't even like them. I decide to take my time. I walk super slow and think about all the cool things I could be doing instead of grocery shopping. Like studying the bird's nest outside my parents' bedroom window. There are 2 baby birds inside. There used to be 3. I pretend the third one went off on a fantastic journey somewhere, but I know better because I've read all about the nestling stage and I know how tough life can be for baby birds. It's hard to protect yourself when you can't fly. Sometimes they fall out of the nest. Sometimes another animal kidnaps and eats them. If I wasn't searching for avocados at the Super Saver, I could be at home watching over the other two birds, even though the tree is too high for me to reach them and I have to turn my head at a crazy angle to even get a peek. But still, at least they would know someone was watching over them, like Saint René watches over me. Even though I think avocados are weird and gross, I'm excellent at choosing the perfect ones. You have to pick an avocado that is darker in color, not too green. Then you place it in the palm of your hand and squeeze gently, real gently. If you squeeze too hard, your avocado will get all bruised up. You want it to be soft but firm. If it squishes too much, it could be rotten. But if it squishes just a little, it's probably ripe and ready. As soon as I have three perfect avocados, an announcement comes over the loudspeaker and roars in my hearing aids. Sometimes I think life is better when you can't hear all the noise. I can't make out every word, but I think I hear specials of the week, which means it's going to be a 5-hour-long announcement. I'm close to the automatic door, so I step through to get away from the sound, but then I remember I'm holding the avocados and I don't want to be a shoplifter, so I stop where I am and look at this bulletin board near the entryway, like that was my plan the whole time. The announcement stops as soon as I see something interesting. Kaori Tanaka, psychic. New clients welcome. No adults. Psychic? No adults? I didn't know there were psychics who only specialized in certain age groups. I nibble at my bottom lip and stare at the words psychic and no adults for what seems like 100 years. A thought forms in my head. I know psychics focus on the future, but I don't care about my future. I'm worried about my right now, and right now, I'm sleep-deprived. I yank off the card, get the number, and pull my phone out of my back pocket. I text the number one-handed, trying hard not to drop the avocados. I'm not as worried about my phone because my mom bought this super protector so the screen wouldn't break if I dropped it. Except she said, when, not if. Even though I've never broken anything in my whole life. Well, not that she knows of. Hi, just saw your card at store. Do you know anything about dreams? I wait. Right away, the word bubble pops up. She's typing. Yes, I know everything about dreams. I've studied Freud. Would you like an appointment? Someone bumps into me, and I realize that I'm standing too close to the automatic doors. I take a step closer to the bulletin board. I'm just about to text back when it dawns on me that the person I'm texting could be a mass murderer or something. Just because the card says Kaori Tanaka doesn't mean the person is actually Kaori Tanaka. Or maybe the person is Kaori Tanaka, but Kaori Tanaka is an insane escaped madwoman who likes to eat 11-year-olds for breakfast. How old are you? How do I know you're not crazy killer? I'm 12 and don't be ridiculous. You don't sound 12. The bubble appears again. That's because I'm the reincarnated spirit of a 65-year-old freedom fighter. I'm not sure if this makes me feel better or not. I should give this some thought. I slip the phone back into my pocket and walk toward the other end of the store to search for my mother. Along the way, I see this scrunchy-faced boy from school. I think his name is Chet. The reason I know this is because Mr. Piper likes to write names on the board when kids act up, which is totally juvenile, but sometimes teachers treat us like we're 7 years old. Teachers and parents have a lot in common. Anyway, this boy's name is always on the board because he acts like a complete moron most of the time. I don't know his last name, but it doesn't matter. I don't even think of him as Chet. I think of him as Scrunch. I know that's not very nice, but what can I say? His face is scrunched up, like he's sniffing something offensive. He's got beady eyes and round cheeks, and they're all shoved up together. Meanness always shows on people's faces. Sometimes you have to look hard for it. Sometimes it's just a part of a person's features. That's how it is with this Chet. So, Scrunch is walking toward the checkout lanes with a grown-up Scrunch, his dad, I guess, as I'm walking in the opposite direction. I stare right at him as I walk by, because I already know something's coming, and it does. He sticks his fingers in both of his ears, crosses his eyes, and juts his tongue out of the side of his mouth. He's been doing this ever since the first day of school, when he realized I was deaf. He really needs to come up with new material. "You're a doofus," I say. I don't know if he hears me or not, but I don't care. Let him hear.
Chapter 10 The Bullens Boys. There was something weird about being deaf. It wasn't natural. That girl had a lot of nerve. Chet kind of suspected she wasn't really deaf anyway. He wondered if she was just faking so she could spy on everyone. If she was deaf, how come she could talk? Even if it sounded like her mouth was full of marbles, she was probably faking that too. Plus, she knew how to read lips, and that was just plain creepy. She probably read all their lips and kept a diary of their secrets. She probably knew everything, like who stole from the vending machine or carved curse words into the desks. And that made Chet's skin crawl, considering he was the one who did both of those things. Chet looked up at his father. His dad had his after-work look, as his mom called it. No tie, dress shirt unbuttoned at the collar, black slacks. Chet wasn't 100% sure what his dad did at work, but whatever it was, Chet wanted to do it too. Something about corporate sales, whatever that was. Something that made Mr. Bullens an important person who sometimes had to travel to faraway places like Europe or Seattle. Mr. Bullens liked to say that a smart man had an answer for every question. That's how you get respect. You know more than anyone else, and you teach people who aren't as smart as you. Respect came in two flavors, Mr. Bullens said. Fear or admiration. Sometimes both. Otherwise, you're just a weakling at the bottom of the food chain, ready to get crushed under someone else's boot. That's why Chet liked asking his dad questions. He always got an answer. Learn something new. "What makes people deaf?" Chet asked. Mr. Bullens stopped and picked up a family-sized bag of Doritos. Chet's dad loved Doritos. Sometimes he'd ask Chet to pick up a bag of chips for the house, any kind he wanted, and Chet always got Doritos, even though he secretly preferred Cheetos.
"Don't know. Lots of things, I guess," Mr. Bullens said, tossing the Doritos in the cart. "Some people are just born defective. Why, do you see one?"
Chet casually glanced behind him. Valencia was gone, but he could still feel her glare. There was definitely something wrong with that girl. Deaf people were just weird, that's all.
"Nah," Chet said. "I was just wondering. They've got a few working here. Sometimes the grocery store gives jobs to those kind of people. Like a favor, you know? Disabled people don't have it all going on upstairs."
Mr. Bullens tapped his forehead.
"But they can figure out how to bag groceries."
Chet nodded.
"I heard you outside banging the basketball in the driveway last night," Mr. Bullens said.
They walked past the crackers and cookies. Mr. Bullens eyed everything without really looking at it.
"Still practicing, huh?"
Chet felt his neck get warm. He hoped it wouldn't turn red.
"Yep, I figure if I practice all summer, I might make the team this time. Tryouts aren't until fall, so... Chet shrugged. Maybe if he played it casual, he'd look like it was no big deal. Fake it till you make it. He'd heard that somewhere.
Mr. Bullen said, "The coach isn't likely to forget the stink of last year's tryouts."
They moved out of the aisle. Mr. Bullens surveyed the checkout lines to find the shortest one. Chet followed closely behind.
"How many shots did you make last night?"
his father asked. Chet shoved his hands in his pockets and lumbered along more slowly as his father committed to cashier 7.
"A bunch?" he said, clearing his throat. "I lost count."
Mr. Bullens turned to him and smiled widely. He patted Chet hard on the shoulder and pinched the back of his neck.
"We can't all be basketball stars. You'll find your sport. It's just not on the court, that's all."
His father now turned his attention to the conveyor belt. The woman in front of them had it covered with frozen dinners, snack cakes, and 2-liter sodas. The woman was large. Her house dress made her look even larger. Mr. Bullens leaned toward his son and said under his breath,
"She ought to buy more vegetables, eh?"
He laughed. The woman glanced their way and gave them a snarling look, similar to the one Valencia had given Chet. He wondered if the woman had heard. He hoped she had. Sometimes the only way to teach people was to embarrass them, wake them up, make them see the error of their ways. That's what Mr. Bullens always said. It worked, too. People usually straightened up when Mr. Bullens was around. Chet laughed.
"Yeah," he said.
The woman had a lot of groceries, so it took a while for the Bullens boys to unload their items. Hot dogs, Doritos, ground beef, ice cream sandwiches, buttered popcorn, graham crackers, and 2 Hershey bars. The teenage cashier was slow and fumbly, with a face full of pimples. His name was Kenny, according to his name tag, which hung crookedly off his shirt pocket. Underneath, it said trainee.
"By the time we get out of here, my son will be graduating from high school," said Mr. Bullens.
He laughed to show he was only joking.
"More like college," Chet added,
loud enough so only his dad could hear. Chapter 11. Beware the Color Red. Guinea pigs don't have normal sleeping schedules. Virgil learned this from the internet. They were small and weak, easy for other animals to snatch up and eat, so they had to be prepared at all times. That didn't leave much time for restful sleep. Instead, guinea pigs, like Gulliver, slept in fits and starts, in 15-minute intervals. Virgil could never really tell when Gulliver was sleeping, since his eyes were always open, and he spent a lot of time hiding in his plastic tree hut. That's not to say Gulliver was quiet. Even though he still held on to his instinctual ways, he was comfortable enough that he ventured around the cage and made quite a bit of noise. He liked to rattle his water bottle, for one thing. That's what woke Virgil up at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning.
Rattle, rattle. Rattle, rattle.
"Ugh. Gulliver,"
Virgil mumbled. He threw the blankets over his head. But it was no use. He was awake for good. Maybe it was for the best. Now he could enjoy breakfast, get Gulliver packed, and have plenty of time to find the 5 stones. He wondered, for about the zillionth time, what Cowrie planned to do with them. Maybe she'd use them to pelt him in the head, so he could stop doing things like hiding behind freezer doors at the Super Saver. He got up, stretched, and opened his bedroom door. He listened. All was quiet. Good. He walked on the balls of his feet down the hall, careful not to make any noise so he wouldn't wake anyone up. For his sake, not theirs. His parents and brothers were a lot to take at any time of the day, but especially in the morning. The whole house was quiet.
It was marvelous. Virgil was so overjoyed at the stillness of his usually bustling house that he didn't even glance at the kitchen table as he opened the refrigerator. He was too busy relishing in the discovery that he could hear his thoughts. No one talking loud or laughing louder. No one calling him turtle. He reached for the milk. The morning was off to a glorious start. He'd sit quietly and have his Cinnamon Toast Crunch and consider the day ahead. He'd think about finding 5 stones, each of a different size, in the woods near Cowrie's house. He wasn't supposed to go exploring in the woods, but he knew that was the best place to find good stones. Sure, he could have stolen some out of the garden in the back, but for some reason that didn't feel right. Like it didn't count. He wasn't sure Cowrie would approve of garden stones.
"You're using too much milk."
Virgil jumped. A splash of milk missed his cereal and landed with a splat on the counter. It was Lola, reading a magazine at the kitchen table.
"You scared me," said Virgil.
"You should always survey a room when you enter it," Lola replied. "Take a good look around. Never be caught off guard."
"I was busy thinking."
Virgil wiped up the spill, returned the milk to the fridge, and carried his bowl to the table. Lola was right. He'd used too much milk. The bowl was filled to the brim. Lola put down her magazine and narrowed her eyes.
"You've been doing a lot of thinking lately. What's going on in that brain of yours? And don't tell me more green bean stories."
Virgil paused. He wouldn't tell her about Valencia. He wasn't ready. This was one thing he didn't want her advice on. But it certainly wouldn't hurt to get her thoughts on a few other things. Virgil took a heaping bite of cereal and said,
"Do you believe in fate?"
Lola sat back.
"Oh, yes," she said. "Certainly I do."
"So you believe things happen for a reason?"
"Jesus, don't talk with your mouth full." "And yes, I do. I think good things happen for a reason. And bad things, too."
Virgil swallowed.
"Why do you always bring up the bad things?"
"If you didn't have bad things, you wouldn't have good things. They would all just be things. Did you ever think about that?"
"No."
Virgil looked at his cereal.
"I guess not."
"I believe in signs, too, Virgilio."
She raised her eyebrow like she was harboring a deep secret.
"What kind of signs?"
Lola leaned forward.
"Last night, I had a dream about a boy named Amado. He was walking through a meadow when he saw a bright red tree. He was so mesmerized by this tree that he decided to walk to it, even though everyone told him not to. 'No, no,' they said. 'Don't go, Amado. The tree is bad, very bad.' But Amado didn't listen. He had never seen a tree like it. On he went."
She pressed her fingertip to the tabletop, as if Amado was standing right there.
"There he goes, ignoring everybody. And do you know what happened?"
Virgil lifted a spoonful of milk to his lips and slurped.
"The tree ate him?"
"Yes, exactly."
She leaned back in her chair again.
"So, you know what the sign is, Virgilio?"
"Don't walk up to trees when people say not to."
"No. Beware the color red."
"Beware the color red?"
"Just for today."
She pointed to Virgil.
"That's my advice to you today. You remember, Virgilio, yes?"
"Yes, Lola," said Virgil before scooping another spoonful. "I'll remember."
Chapter 12. Valencia. There is a special light in the hallway that blinks when someone rings the doorbell. This morning I wake up and see it flashing through my half-open bedroom door. I'm not sure what kind of sadist rings doorbells at 7:30 on a Saturday morning, but I'm going to find out because I'm the only one awake. I can tell by the way the house feels, like even the walls are asleep. I walk down the hall in my bare feet. I don't bother with my hearing aids. A man with a salt-and-pepper mustache and a girl with brown eyes and freckles are at the door. They have pamphlets tucked under their arms. I can tell they aren't lost. They look like they are just where they need to be, which is strange because I've never seen them before. The man says hello and introduces the both of them, but his mustache makes it hard for me to understand him. I think his name is Craig or Greg, and her name is something indecipherable with an E, maybe? Something that doesn't make you move your lips, like Enid. Before he and his mustache go any further, I point to my ear and shake my head to show that I'm deaf, and he looks at me like I just sprouted vines from my head. Then he hands me a pamphlet in a big hurry, and he and the freckled girl step away from the door and wave goodbye. He moves his mouth in such an exaggerated way that I can see all his teeth when he says, "Nice to meet you," which is really easy to lip-read because everyone says it. I can tell he's saying it really loudly, as if that would make a difference. As they walk away, the girl turns and looks at me like I'm a zoo exhibit. I think about sticking my tongue out at her, but I don't. They're going to have a rude awakening anyway, because they're headed next door to Mrs. Franklin's house, and she doesn't like when people come by unannounced. Plus, Mrs. Franklin has 3 cats, and they're the meanest cats you ever saw. I have a feeling those cats would claw that man's mustache off if Mrs. Franklin told them to. I close the door and look at the pamphlet. It looks like something for church. On the outside it says, in great big letters, "Only those who listen to the word can hear it." That's kind of funny, all things considered. But it's really a shame that Greg/Craig didn't stay to talk to me, because I bet there aren't many people who would be willing to listen, especially since they're going around ringing doorbells at 7:30 on a Saturday morning. I would have listened, though. Had they stayed, I would have asked all about their church and what kinds of things they do, and I would have asked if they thought God was a boy or a girl or an old man with a white beard, and I would have asked if they knew about Saint Rene, and if they didn't, I would have told them. And maybe I could have made them coffee because I know how. And I would have asked what time their church services started and if they baptized people, and if so, how. But instead, I'm staring at the pamphlet like an idiot. I toss it in the kitchen trash because I know neither of my parents will care. My dad comes down the hallway. He's scratching the back of his neck the way he always does when he first wakes up.
"Who was at the door, Cupcake?"
I can tell that's what he says because it's a logical question and he always calls me Cupcake. I should probably hate it because it's a babyish nickname, but I hope he calls me Cupcake even when I'm really old, like 30. "Church people," I say. I pull the pamphlet out of the trash and show it to him. He rolls his eyes.
"What do you plan to do today?"
he asks. Then he yawns and walks toward the pantry. He's going to make himself a bowl of cereal. That's what he does every morning. Sometimes he even eats cereal for dinner. No one eats more cereal than my dad. And he likes the real sugary kind, the ones that make your teeth rot, at least according to my mom. For some reason, it really irritates her that he eats so much cereal. She says it's not real food. "I'm going out to explore with my zoological diary," I say. I don't mention the part about going to see Cowrie. Turns out, my need to find a cure for nightmares outweighs my fear of maniacs. I've decided to take my chances. My appointment is at 1 o'clock. 1 sharp, actually. Apparently, Kaori Tanaka is very serious about being on time, which makes me think maybe she's not a killer. I don't think punctuality would be number one on her list of worries if she was. For added protection, I didn't give her my real identity. When she asked, I told her my name was Renee. She asked for my last name, but I said, "It's just Renee." I couldn't think of a fake last name fast enough. I return to my room as my dad pours milk over his Cap'n Crunch. Maybe I'll fall back to sleep. It's still early, and I'm not ready to be awake. I shake my Crystal Caverns globe, then get under the covers before the bats settle back down in the water. Kaori told me she lives on the other side of the woods. That's good news, because it's not far. Otherwise, I don't know how I would make it to her house. It's also great luck because I know the woods like the back of my hand. I know there's a special clearing where groundhogs come out at dusk. I know there's an old abandoned water well that's missing its rope and pail, which tells me that the woods used to be an empty field where someone had a house, which means that the trees are young, at least as far as trees go. There are sycamore, pin oaks, and poplars. I know there's a cluster of trees with leaves that turn brilliant shades of yellow in the fall. It's one of my favorite places, and it's where I do most of my journaling. I've even walked through the whole length of it and come out the other side into a neighborhood. Maybe I've even seen Kaori's house before. You never know. She should put a sign in her yard or something. Drum up more business. I close my eyes and think about that pamphlet. I wonder where Mustache's church is. I wish I'd asked him. Oh, well. I can pretend I'm in a church. I imagine that I'm sitting in a pew. Would Mustache's church have pews or chairs? And looking up at a big, big altar, talking to Saint Renee. He doesn't look at me like I have vines sprouting from my head, because he understands. I try to picture Saint Renee wearing hearing aids in both ears like I do. "Dear Saint Renee," I say, "I've been thinking about that whole going solo thing, and I'm not sure it's the best idea after all. It'd be nice if I didn't have to go to Kaori Tanaka's house alone, just in case she eats 11-year-olds for breakfast. I didn't have the nightmare last night, which is good because I need to be alert. Kaori may or may not be a mass murderer. If she is, please protect me. Thank you. Amen." I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say amen or not, but it sounds good. So, amen.
Chapter 13. Snakes. Chet woke up on Saturday morning thinking about snakes. John Davies claimed that he had found a snake skin in the woods near the school, and Chet planned to one-up him. He wouldn't just find snake skin. He'd capture an actual snake. He knew just how he would do it, too. He'd find a good, long stick. Then he'd look for places where snakes hang out, like in the brush or tall grass or something. And he'd poke around until he heard one move. He'd poke and poke and poke, standing at a distance, of course, he wasn't stupid. Until the snake raised its head and hissed, or whatever snakes did. And as soon as it lifted up off the ground to attack him, he would snatch it by its tail so he wouldn't get bit, then grab it under the head as fast as possible with his other hand. He was quick. Quicker than a snake, that's for sure. And he wasn't scared, either. Today would be the day. It was meant to be. His favorite thing about snakes was how they swallowed their prey with one giant gulp. People were afraid of snakes, too, but that just showed how cowardly people were. Not Chet, though. At last year's field trip, he had held a boa constrictor without a second thought, even though Miss Bosch and the keeper of the reptile house, Mr. Frederick, said it could crush bones just by squeezing. "You're all cowards," Chet had announced to everyone in earshot, "scared of a little old snake." David Kistler crossed his arms. "Doesn't look little to me," he said. "Figures you'd be scared of it, Kistler," said Chet. You can't even run 10 steps without dropping dead. David was a short kid with asthma, who always carried an inhaler. Chet puffed out his chest and continued, "Besides, it won't hurt me. He knows who's boss." Chet's arms began to ache from the weight. He didn't let on, but he also didn't argue when Mr. Frederick reached over to return the snake to its tank. That was when the Valencia girl had raised her hand. She had a lot of nerve asking questions, Chet thought. When Mr. Frederick called on her, she asked,
"Can snakes hear?"
The class snickered, Chet included. David shot everyone a mean look and said, "Shut up," to no one in particular. Everyone did. Even Chet, but only because Mr. Frederick was about to start talking again. A kid the size of a first grader who sucked on an inhaler all the time sure had a lot of nerve shushing people, Chet thought. Mr. Frederick made a seesaw motion with his hand as if to say, "So-so." "Excellent question," said Mr. Frederick. "Snakes don't have ears, but they can hear through vibrations in the skin. The vibrations travel to the inner ear, and that's how the snake hears the sound. It's not the same kind of sounds that you or I hear, though. Scientists aren't sure what it actually sounds like." Figures she would ask a question about ears when she didn't have any that worked, Chet thought. Then again, she probably wore those big hearing aids just to get extra attention. She didn't even try to hide them, which only proved his point. Plus, she spent Thursday afternoons in the resource room, which was way easier than regular class. On the other days of the week, the teachers wore microphones that worked with her hearing aids somehow. Talk about special treatment. And the teachers never called on her or asked her to come up to the board to solve problems unless she raised her hand. Meanwhile, they hounded Chet. "Come sit up front. Stop that. Leave that kid alone. Where's your homework?" This Valencia girl was nothing more than a con artist. Chet watched her as she eyed the boa constrictor. Maybe she used the hearing aids to tune into some other world, and she was a witch, or she practiced voodoo at home or something. Maybe she spoke to people and animals with her mind. There was something off about the whole thing. When the class filed out, Valencia stayed behind, studying the snake, and no one even told her to move. Not even Mr. Frederick. It was like she was invisible. That girl got away with everything. Chapter 14. The Universe Knows. Petty items like furniture crowded the spirit chamber, so Cowrie kept it sparse. Her parents forced her to have a bed, but she convinced them to banish the dresser to the garage. Her closet was overstuffed, but it was worth it. The extra space allowed her to examine the star chart from various angles, which was exactly what she was doing at 8 o'clock Saturday morning after nudging her sister out of bed. There was important business to consider. How does one unite a Pisces and Scorpio without interfering with the destiny of the stars? This was a delicate matter. It was one thing to use the existing magnetic forces of fate. It was another to manipulate the universe to do your bidding. She needed a plan.
"The stars are aligned in their favor," Cowrie said.
She stood in front of the star chart with her shoulders squared, feet apart, hands on her hips.
"How can you tell?"
Gen asked. She was standing the same way, only her pajama bottoms were inside out, and she had the jump rope looped around her waist like a sash.
"Looks like nothing but a bunch of dots and lines."
Cowrie sighed.
"I've told you a million times. The dots are stars, and the lines are the constellations. And it's not lines in the first place. It's pictures. See? This is Orion. The three stars are his belt. He's hunting. Can't you tell?"
Gen tilted her head to the right, then the left.
"Looks like lines. And this is Andromeda and Pegasus, see?
Kauri indicated points on the star chart.
Yeah, I can see because they have names written right next to them, but it still looks like lines.
Kauri sighed again.
Forgive her, she said to the spirits.
How is this supposed to help us figure out what to do? The stars tell us everything. It's fate, Gen. Fate in the stars. There are no coincidences.
Gen squinted at the chart.
Is my fate in there?
Sure.
Your fate is to help me figure out what to do. I thought Virgil was just going to bring us some rocks and we were going to do abracadabra stuff.
Stones, not rocks.
That's the same thing.
Not really.
What's the difference, then?
Kauri rubbed her head.
It's just different. Jeez, can't you let me think? You have no idea what we're up against, bringing these two signs together. Maybe they weren't meant to be friends. Just because they have the same initials doesn't mean anything.
I have the same initials as Gertrude Tomlinson, and I don't like her at all. She broke three of my pink glitter pencils and didn't even apologize, and she chewed off the erasers, which is totally gross.
They're meant to be friends. It's fate. I know it, Kauri said. Somehow the universe figures these things out.
How?
Like putting them in the same place at the same time, or using a special force like me to help them find their way.
They were in the same place at the same time for a whole year at school.
And they didn't even speak.
That was Virgil, not the universe. You can see how shy he is. He carries a rodent in his backpack, Gen.
A rodent!
It's not a rodent, it's a guinea pig.
That's what guinea pigs are. They're rodents, just like rats or squirrels or mice.
I think Gulliver's cute.
I'm just saying, it can't be easy for Virgil. First off, he's a Pisces.
Kauri turned away from the star chart and walked to the edge of her circle rug. Gen followed at her heels.
Look at the sign for Pisces. It's two fish swimming in opposite directions. Do you know why?
Gen shook her head.
Because Pisces are always at odds with themselves. They're never quite sure what to do. No self-confidence. Overly sensitive.
Gen squatted down to get a good look at the fish.
Now, look at Scorpio, Kauri said.
Gen's dark eyes shifted to the neighboring sign on the rug.
Ew, it's a bug.
No, Kauri snapped, as if Gen had just cursed both their parents.
Well, yes, it's a bug, but not just any bug. It's a scorpion, Gen, a scorpion. Do you know what that means?
She has a tail? Kauri apologized to the spirits again, then said,
No, it means she's sharp and independent. She's assertive, full of confidence. She's probably got a little temper, too, and a ton of friends all competing for her attention while poor Virgil talks to a rodent. Basically, they're the exact opposite of each other. Nothing in common, I bet. Not a thing.
Gen considered this. She looked up at her sister.
Maybe she likes rodents, too.
Kauri sighed for a third time.
Don't be ridiculous, she said.
Chapter 15. Valencia. Squirrels are one of my favorite animals. I decide that's going to be my focus today as I cross the woods. I'm going to study the squirrels and feed Sacred, my pet dog. Okay, he's not really my dog, but he may as well be. I take care of him more than anyone else, I guarantee you that. He could be my pet if my parents weren't so anti-dog. They claim they aren't, but they refuse to let me bring Sacred home because they say pets are a big responsibility and they don't want to be the ones taking care of him. I tell them the whole point is that he would be my pet, which means I would take care of him, but they don't listen. They don't think I'm responsible enough to take care of a dog, but how would they know? We've never had one. I think they just don't want a dog in the house. If that's the case, they should just say so instead of blaming the whole thing on my perceived lack of responsibility. I don't get them sometimes. I really don't. So because my parents think I don't know how to feed or walk a dog, Sacred is stuck out there in the woods, fending for himself. I take good care of him. I bring him a bowl of food every time I go animal watching, and he always shows up. He's the sweetest dog. You wouldn't know it to look at him, not at first. He's a big dog, and he looks mean because he's kinda mangy. I mean, he lives by his wits in the woods, so he isn't exactly wagging his tail 24 hours a day. But all I had to do was look at his face, and I knew he was friendly. You know how I said meanness shows up in people's faces? It's the same for dogs, too. It's the same for all animals who have eyes, most of the time. Sacred is all black. For some reason, people are more afraid of black dogs than dogs of any other color. Now that I think about it, it's the same for cats, too. I don't know why. Dogs and cats can't exactly control the color of their fur, so why does it make a difference if they're born with black fur or brown fur? It's all hair. People are weird sometimes, I swear. I decide to head into the woods around 10:30. That will give me plenty of time to document squirrel activity in my log, feed Sacred, and get to Kauri's house without rushing. But first, I need to swipe a bowl from the kitchen. Every now and then, my parents have styrofoam or plastic bowls on hand, but most of the time they don't, so I have to secretly take a real one. I always pick the ones my parents don't use so they won't notice. But lately, Mom's been going through the cabinets, and I think she suspects something. I can see her mind wondering, "What happened to my bowls?" Here's the thing. Every time I bring Sacred food in the woods, I plan to return the bowl, wash it, and put it back in the cabinet. No one is the wiser, right? But every now and then, okay, most of the time, Sacred brings the bowl to an undisclosed location, never to be seen again. I know I need a better plan, but I always forget to come up with one, and I don't think about it until I'm about to feed Sacred, like right now, for instance. I make a mental note. Figure out a more creative way to bring food. Maybe I could build a dog feeder and nail it to a tree. But there's no time for that now. I wait until my parents are in the den watching Saturday morning news, which is totally boring and has the worst closed captioning, by the way. And I snatch one of the bowls in a big hurry. I fill it up with cornflakes, 5 slices of bologna, 1 slice of cheese, and a handful of baby carrots. I know it doesn't sound very appetizing. Trust me, it doesn't look appetizing either, but Sacred isn't picky. When you're hungry, you're hungry. Unfortunately, I'm not able to make a simple escape. My mother tugs my shirt before I can get out the door. "Where are you going with that?" she asks. "Outside for breakfast." She looks inside the bowl and raises an eyebrow. "That's what you're eating for breakfast?"
Yes?
Okay, I know I'm not very convincing, but if I tell her I'm going into the woods to feed a stray dog, she'll freak out. She tends to freak out over the dumbest things. "Then I'm going exploring." I turn sideways so she can see the small bag over my shoulder, which carries my journal, aka my zoological diary, and favorite sketching pencil. She considers this, and I consider her. Did I catch her on a good day, or is she going to be a big pain? "Be careful," she says, "and be back by the afternoon. Don't wander too far, either." My mom is like a walking list of do's and don'ts.
"Got it,"
I say. "I love you. Keep your phone on." There's always a footnote to her "I love yous." "I love you. Be home by 4. I love you. Be sure to answer my texts. I love you. Be careful." I wonder if she does it to my dad, too.
"Love you too, Mom. And I will,"
I say as I walk out the door. I guess I use footnotes, too.
Chapter 16. Down, down, down. Of all the treats in the entire world, celery sticks, baby carrots, orange slices, Gulliver liked dandelions best. It took him less than 5 seconds to eat an entire stem, and then he'd root around for more. For Gulliver, dandelions were a rare delicacy. For humans, they were noxious weeds that needed to stop growing. But grow they did. Dandelions were everywhere in Virgil's neighborhood. They sprouted from the cracks in the sidewalk, leaned against rusty fence posts, sneaked into well-manicured lawns. Virgil plucked them habitually, like an explorer searching for gems. By the time he reached the woods, his left pocket was stuffed with them. He could have stuffed the other pocket, too, but he was saving that for the stones. He wasn't allowed to explore the woods alone. The trees were thick in some places and sparse in others. Flowers grew intermittently. A patch of iris here, a colony of dandelions there. Lola was convinced the woods teemed with snakes, but Virgil was certain that he could find 5 stones here. And not just any stones, but the best stones his town had to offer. He found 2 right away, just a few feet into the woods. Deeper in, the sounds of the neighborhood faded away, and he found another just like that. He was so focused on looking down, surveying the ground with his eyes, that he barely noticed the ominous rustling sound behind him. But when he heard the shuffle of feet, he jerked around, heart pounding, and stood very, very still. If there was one thing he knew, it was that you had to stay still when faced with forest beasts, otherwise you could become their supper. He didn't see anything, but he was certain he had heard something. And it wasn't the blowing of the wind or the falling of a twig. Someone, or something, was moving nearby.
"Hello?"
Virgil said, quietly, like a croak. He thought he heard something. A growl? A snort? He suddenly got the idea that there was a rhinoceros on the other side of the trees, pawing its front hoof in the dirt, bowing its head, steadying its horn, ready to charge. He imagined himself being flung into the air and landing on the thick gray skin of the giant creature before being trampled. One of Lola's old ghost stories popped into his head, too. She said there was once a man who told all his secrets to the trees, and after he died, the trees whispered them to anyone who passed by. Maybe it wasn't a rhinoceros, but a bunch of old trees that were ready to tell the secrets of the dead. Virgil looked at his phone. It was 10:15. Maybe he'd just snatch up the next stones he saw and rush to Cowrie's house. She might not mind if he got there early. But then the shuffling sound receded and disappeared, and the woods were quiet again. Virgil exhaled. His heart slowed. He looked at his feet, saw a 4th stone, and put it in his pocket. He wondered if he'd picked the best ones. He wondered so deeply that he didn't hear the other shuffling sound, this time approaching from behind.
"Hey, retardo."
Virgil turned around, startled. Chet Bullens's meaty face was a light shade of red, like it was ready to burst.
"What are you doing out here all by yourself? Lost your mommy?"
It occurred to Virgil that the bull was also out here by himself, but he wasn't about to point that out. Instead, Virgil said nothing. He stood there, one pocket full of stones and the other full of dandelions, feeling very dumb, like someone had lifted him out of one story and placed him in another. In these unfamiliar woods, in this unfamiliar situation, alone with the bull who was carrying a pillowcase. Virgil wondered what the pillowcase was for, and in the space of about 3 seconds he thought of a handful of terrifying scenarios. The bull would smother him with it. He was using it to carry the bodies of dead animals. He was going to capture animals, smother them, then carry their dead bodies. And Chet wasn't just carrying a pillowcase. He was also wearing a Chicago Bulls t-shirt.
"Beware the color red."
Suddenly, the rhinoceros didn't seem so bad.
"What's the matter?"
the bull said.
"Oh yeah, I forgot. You don't know how to talk. You're a retard. I see you going into that retard class all the time. What goes on in there anyways? A bunch of kids wetting their pants, I bet."
In addition to being afraid of the dark, carrying a guinea pig in his backpack and stuffing his pockets full of dandelions and rocks, Virgil had another secret. He weighed only 76 pounds, and even though he pretended to be 5 feet tall, he was actually 4'11". Virgil wasn't sure how much the bull weighed or how tall he was, but he certainly weighed more than 76 pounds.
"You really are stupid, huh?" the bull said.
His eyes shifted to Virgil's backpack. Chet took a step forward, and Virgil took a step back, which the bull thought was hilarious, because he immediately broke into peals of laughter before ripping Virgil's backpack off his shoulders with such force that Virgil spun, actually spun, and hit the ground with a numbing whack that shot from the palms of his hands to his shoulders. The bull took off like a bullet. Virgil pushed himself up and ran after him, saying, "No! No! No!" in the loudest voice he could manage without choking.
"Gulliver! Gulliver!"
he cried. Or maybe he only said it in his head. He wasn't sure. The bull darted between the trees, not laughing anymore, just running with Virgil's backpack in his hands. A million horrifying images blazed through Virgil's mind. The bull tearing Gulliver in two, feeding him to a pit of lions, picking him up and tossing him into the trees, which is why he didn't feel any better when the bull finally stopped running and turned to face him, his cheeks flushed and his neck and hairline glistening. Virgil waited for him to open the backpack, discover Gulliver, and destroy him. Instead, the bull took a giant step back, grinned evilly, and turned toward a stumpy circle of stones that Virgil had never noticed before. It was an old well. With two hefty shoves, the bull pushed the cover of the well aside and dangled the backpack over the now open hole.
"Say bye-bye to your stuff, retardo," he said.
The bull let go, and the bag fell into the dark, gaping well, so far down that Virgil didn't even hear it land.
"Guess you'll have to get new books, pansy boy," the bull said, his smile widening. "Not that you need them anyway, since you probably don't know how to read."
The bull wiped his hands on the front of his jeans as if he just finished a dirty, dirty deed, which he had. And then he turned and walked away, disappearing into the woods and leaving Virgil alone. Chapter 17 Going Underground. There are more than 7,000 islands in the Philippines. Some don't even have people living on them. And then there are some that once had people, but don't anymore. Like the lowland island of Balatama. Lola had told Virgil all about it. According to Lola, Balatama was once a thriving island in the south. It thrived so much that the people kept taking, taking, taking land that belonged to the mountain creatures. One day, the people cut down a gathering of trees that belonged to a majestic bird named Pa. Pa had the wingspan of an elephant and talons as sharp as knives. When his trees were cut down, he was so angry that he grew bigger and bigger. When he spread his wings, they were so large and dark that they blotted out the sunlight. This made Pa happy, because the darkness blinded the villagers. They would get lost and wander in circles, and then Pa would swoop down, pluck them up, and eat them. Pa controlled the darkness and used it as a weapon. He knew that darkness turned people weak because it confused them and made them wander. The darkness created easy victims because no one could fight an enemy they could not see. Pa's talons would sever the villagers in half before they even realized they were in trouble. Virgil was 8 years old the first time he heard the story.